Chapter 6 Amber Eyes. With 1,000 dwarves marching behind her, Catti Bree, astride the mighty unicorn Andahar, led the way to the gates of Luskan. Athrogate and Ambergris rode at her side, the two of them assigned by Brunner to serve as her personal bodyguards. Many threatening looks came at the woman, and particularly at her entourage, from the scalawags serving as gate guards, rogues in the service of one or another of the 5 competing captains of Luskan. But Jarlaxle's hold on the city was so powerful, not a single word was spoken, not even a request for the leaders to identify the approaching army. The gates were pulled open without a word, and Catti Bree led the way into the city.
"Take me to the host tower," she ordered one of the nearby guards, a woman so dark from the sun and dirty from the streets she looked as if she had the shadow of a beard.
Still without a word of response, she escorted them up Reaver's Run, the main boulevard that led all the way to the city's main market. Beyond that lay the bridge to Close Guard Island, which housed the ship of High Captain Kurth, who was, of course, Jarlaxle's lieutenant, Beniago. Indeed, Beniago waited at the far end of the bridge, bidding the newcomers to cross. He took up beside Catti Bree and led the way to the next bridge, from Close Guard to Cutlass Island, where once had stood the host tower of the Arcane. Large tents had already been constructed all around the ruins of that once grand structure.
"Food will be brought to you daily," Beniago assured Catti Bree.
"Enough to keep me belly fat?"
Athrogate demanded. Beniago, who knew Athrogate well, merely laughed and nodded.
"Aye, better be,"
the dwarf grunted. Catti Bree moved over to the roots of the ruined structure as the dwarves settled in. The devastation had been so complete that she could look down into what had once been the basement of the tower, and even below that broken stone and metal to the deep roots trailing down into the Underdark. These were the roots that ran to Gontalgrim, delivering seawater to the elementals that held the fire primordial in its pit. She looked up at the darkening sky. The sun had slipped below the horizon, but only recently. The clouds to the west flared pink and orange in the dying light. The wind was off the water, wet and chill in her face, and Catti Bree pulled her black cloak, the cloak Jarlaxle had given her, tighter about her.
"A daunting task," Gromf Beanri said, and the woman jumped and nearly transformed into a raven and flew away. The drow was suddenly there, out of nowhere it seemed, standing perfectly calm beside her. She gave an incredulous look, and he returned a smile that reminded her of their respective powers. She knew Gromf's appearance and demeanor was meant to intimidate her, so she calmed herself quickly and presented herself more forcefully. She did a good job of hiding the winding line of terror that continued to twist inside her. Catti Bree trusted in her powers and her relationship with Mieliki. She had returned to this world with clear goals, and that guiding purpose had dominated her existence over the more than 2 decades of her second life. She had trained with powerful wizards, studied in the extensive library of the Harples, communed closely with a goddess. But this was Gromf Beanri, recently the Archmage of Menzo Baranzon. He had magically appeared right beside her without a hint of warning or a tingle that anything was amiss. Catti Bree understood that he could very likely destroy her just as easily and unexpectedly.
"I have examined pieces of the fallen tower already," Gromf explained. "All the materials are available. We have paintings and have uncovered design sketches of the tower in the bowels of Ilusk, below this city. The dwarf should have no trouble replicating the physical structure."
"That is the easy part," Catti Bree said.
Gromf stared at the hole in the ground and nodded.
"Why are you doing this?"
Catti Bree asked bluntly, and he looked up to match her blue eyes with his amber orbs, the two locking stares intently.
"If I wished you to know,
amuse me,"
she heard herself saying, and couldn't believe the words as they came forth. Gromf was the one who seemed amused, and he looked back to the hole.
"You intend to inhabit the tower when it is rebuilt,"
Catti Bree said in a voice that sounded far too accusatory.
"If it suits me," Gromf answered,
I intend to live wherever I desire to live. Would you wish to try to stop me?
In this city run by drow?
Grumph looked up at her again and flashed a wicked smile.
Here or anywhere, he clarified.
Catty Bree swallowed hard, but she did not allow herself to blink and did not look away.
You fear for the dwarves, Grumph surmised. You fear that if I am in control of the new host tower, I might use that position against the magic that preserves Gontalgrim.
Catty Bree saw no need to answer.
It is a reasonable fear, of course, said Grumph. Or it would be, except for two important matters. First, the magic of the host tower isn't enacted like that of a wand. I will not call upon the tower to fuel the elementals enslaving the primordial any more than I can tell the tower not to do so. I expect you will understand this as we go through the process. Surely no instrument of such power would have ever been left to the whims of whomever happened to be serving as the leader of the host tower at any particular time in its millennia of existence. Particularly not since the dwarves helped build the original tower, from all that I can tell. And second, I am not a simple and capricious murderer. What reason would I have to destroy Gontalgrim, even if that was within my power?
Why do the drow attack Mithril Hall? Why does Tiago pursue Drizzt? Why?
Gontalgrim in the hands of a dwarf king serves me well at this time, Gromp stated.
And if that changes?
I assure you, human woman, I am not one you wish to anger. And I do not need a host tower beneath my feet to rain destruction wherever I choose.
You say such things, and expect me to trust you in this most important endeavor.
I speak the simple truth, and know that you have no choice in the matter. If you believe that you can reconstruct the host tower of the Arcane without my aid, then you prove the drow matron mothers correct when they proclaim the stupidity of humans.
Catty Bree was very relieved at that moment when Beniago walked up to stand beside her. Jarlaxle and his many henchmen would protect them all from the wrath of Grumph.
Braylon Jonquet has returned to serve in House Doerden, Grumph asked in the drow tongue,
and Catty Bree was glad to learn that she could still understand the language well enough to keep up with the fast-speaking wizard. A mixed blessing, she realized, when Beniago answered in perfect drow.
Yes, uncle.
Uncle. The web around her was daunting. Catty Bree walked away to a tent she had taken as her own. As she neared the closed flap, she shut her eyes and pictured again the hole in the ground that had been the grand and wondrous host tower of the Arcane. She tried again to picture that magnificent structure with its branching tendrils. It seemed as much a living thing as something built by elves and dwarves. The image proved fleeting, replaced by something else, something that surprised Catty Bree. The amber eyes of Grumph Beanry, staring at her, measuring her, devouring her. She glanced back to find Grumph looking back at her from the base of the host tower. Shaken, the woman retired to her tent.
Ignore the ghosts, Jarlaxle told Drizzt, as they wound their way through ancient cobweb-filled halls and corridors. Many with stone statues and bas-reliefs so covered by the dust of centuries that they had become unrecognizable. Still, Drizzt understood the design of the place and the architecture and statues enough to suspect that he and Jarlaxle had come into Illusk in their underground meandering.
The spirits have been rendered benign by my associates, Jarlaxle explained. At least benign to those strong enough of mind and will to ignore them. I would expect you are among that group. Such creatures feed and strengthen on fear.
Several of the specters appeared, their faces stretched and elongated as if frozen in some exaggerated, truly horrified scream. The long dead of Illusk floated about the sides of the wide hall Drizzt and Jarlaxle traversed. They leered at them from every shadow, it seemed,
and they whispered in Drizzt's mind, telling him to flee, offering him images of some gruesome impending feast upon his warm flesh. Drizzt looked at his companion, then steeled himself against his budding terror. Trust Jarlaxle, he silently reminded himself. The drow mercenary's casual gait comforted him, reminding him that he was traveling with one of the most capable people Faerun had ever known. So Drizzt found his center and his heart, and in his fortified emotional state, the ghosts became no more to him than moving decorations, like a rolling animation of Ilusk's ancient secrets and history. They came to an area less dusty and forlorn, and with other dark elves of Bregendierth moving about, all pausing to tip a nod to their leader and to Drizzt. At one door, Jarlaxle paused and held his hand up to halt Drizzt. "Pray wait here," the mercenary instructed. "I will return in a moment." Drizzt moved to put his back up against the wall and tried to appear relaxed, though he surely didn't want to be in this place without an escort. But no sooner had Jarlaxle gone through the door than he came back out, shook his head, and apparently reconsidered. He motioned to Drizzt to follow. It was a small chamber with a single bed, a single desk, and a single chair now filled by a lone man, a human, sitting back with his soft boots up on the table. A man Drizzt knew well.
"Drizzt has agreed to join our quest," Jarlaxle explained.
And Artemis and Treri nodded. "You will risk the ways of Menzo Berenzon for the sake of Dalia?" Drizzt asked the assassin.
"You will?"
And Treri returned with equal skepticism.
"Will not Caddy Bree burn with jealousy?"
"She knows I have no interest in Dalia in any way that is threatening to her," Drizzt replied. "I seek to aid an old companion, nothing more." He paused and stared hard at Entreri, beginning to decipher more regarding this unexpected valor from the assassin. "Do you understand that?" After a pause, Entreri offered a slight nod and said convincingly, "I am pleased to have you along." Jarlaxle dropped a mask on the table beside the assassin's legs, and Drizzt recognized that magical item. Jarlaxle had gotten it from him after he had taken it from a banshee named Agatha. It appeared as a simple white stage mask with a tie to hold it in place, but it was so much more.
"You will walk as a drow," Jarlaxle told Entreri. "Every step of the way from this place to Menzo Berenzon and back again. We do not know what eyes will be upon us when we leave the wards my friends have enacted as protection around Ilusk."
Entreri picked up the mask, rolled it over several times with his fingers, and at last managed a nod, one clearly of great reluctance.
"We can afford no mistakes," Jarlaxle explained, "so we will take no chances."
"Would not a simple spell of illusion suffice?"
"Ah, but that is the beauty of Agatha's mask," Jarlaxle explained. "Neither it nor the changes its wearer enacts can be detected with magic."
As he explained things to Entreri, Jarlaxle turned sidelong, his gaze sweeping out to include Drizzt in his warning. Drizzt was looking past Jarlaxle, though, to this enigma he knew as Entreri. He noted the assassin's eyes widening with clear shock, a profound scowl coming over him. Drizzt didn't even have to follow Entreri's gaze to realize he had noted the red blade Jarlaxle wore at his hip. Entreri seemed as if he would melt there and then. His lips moved as if he wanted to say something, but no sound came forth.
"It was not destroyed," Jarlaxle said,
obviously noting the same thing as Drizzt.
"Throw it back in the pit," Entreri demanded.
"You still do not know if your longevity is tied to the blade."
"It is," Entreri stated flatly.
He spat both words and spat before and after for good measure.
"Well, so be it then," Jarlaxle told him.
He drew the blade, laid it on the table, then pulled off the magical gauntlet and put it down beside the sword. Entreri shied away, sliding his chair back.
"Throw it back into the pit,"
he whispered again, seeming on the edge of abject desperation.
No one will hold Karin's claw over you now, Jarlaxle assured him. I give it to you. The Netherese are a fading memory. They'll not hunt the blade now.
I do not want it, Entreri said with a sneer. Destroy it.
I am sure I have no idea how that might be done, said Jarlaxle. Nor would I deign to do so if I did.
You have long demanded of me that I help you retrieve Dahlia from Matron Mother Bayenri, and so we shall.
Not with that, Entreri insisted, his hateful stare never leaving the bone-hilted, red-bladed, diabolical sword.
It's not possible.
Drizzt could feel the pain emanating from Entreri's every word. This sword, Karin's claw, had enslaved him, and with it the shadow of our lord Herzgo Alegni had tortured the man for decades. All of those awful memories resounded clearly now in Entreri's tone. This was not a man used to being submissive, but the obvious level of his fear now truly touched Drizzt. Entreri really had expected to die when he threw Karin's claw into the primordial pit, and yet he had demanded that the sword go in. He, Drizzt, and Dahlia had ventured through danger to the bowels of Gontalgrim for exactly that reason, to destroy Karin's claw, and with it, to destroy Artemis Entreri. It would seem that Entreri hated Karin's claw more than he valued his own life. The question, then, Drizzt knew, was whether or not Entreri hated the sword more than he cared for Dahlia, and that, Drizzt now suspected from Entreri's hesitance and twisting expression, was a different matter entirely. Do you not believe you can dominate the blade? Jarlaxle asked.
I want nothing to do with it.
But it is here and not destroyed, said Drizzt. And if Jarlaxle had not retrieved it, then someone else would have.
Surely such a powerful magical sword would have soon enough found a worthy wielder, and since Karin's claw knows you and is tied to you—
Shut up, said Entreri. The choice is yours, said Jarlaxle. Who is the master, and who the slave?
Entreri's scowl showed that he wasn't buying into that particular line of reasoning.
An excuse, Drizzt interjected rather harshly, and the other two stared at him curiously.
What do you know? Jarlaxle asked.
I know that I am looking upon a coward, and that I never expected, Drizzt stated. He didn't blink as he locked in Treri's gaze with his own.
Our human friend uses the sword to shield his deeper anger.
Entreri shook his head, his expression caught somewhere between outrage and doubt.
You loathe Karin's claw so you won't have to loathe yourself, Drizzt accused.
Isn't that always your way? There is always some external reason for your anger, so you claim, but in truth that reason is—
He waved his hand dismissively and swung about for the door.
You dare?
Entreri muttered.
If we are to be done with this, Jarlaxle, then let us be on with it now, Drizzt said. I miss my wife already.
He paused and gave a derisive snort, and without turning addressed Entreri.
If you mean to run up and attack me, you should do so now while my back is turned.
Shut up, Entreri said again.
Because you cannot bear to hear my words?
Now Drizzt did swing around to face the man. Entreri stared at him hard, and for a moment it seemed he meant to leap across the room and attack Drizzt. But then he just laughed helplessly and whispered,
Yes.
He lowered his gaze to the table and stood there studying the vicious sword that had for so long been the instrument of his torture.
Who is the slave, and who the master?
Jarlaxle asked again.
That choice is wholly your own, Artemis Entreri, Drizzt said.
That sword, powerful as it may be, cannot compel you in any way, if you are your own master first.
Entreri chewed his lip for a moment, never taking his gaze from that cursed blade. Then he moved swiftly, sweeping the glove from the table and sliding his hand into it. With a growl, he took up Karin's claw and raised the blood-red blade up before his eyes.
It seemed to Drizzt that Entreri and the sword shared a private moment then, a private battle. And if Karin's claw had any hold over him, then it would be proven only if Entreri held it without the protective gauntlet.
"Let us be done with this," Entreri said, and he slid the sword into his belt. "And quickly, for surely I will be driven mad with the echoes of Drizzt O'Erden, who has appointed himself as my conscience, sounding about me." Drizzt smiled warmly at that, and even patted Entreri on the shoulder as he moved past with Jarlaxle. For all of the assassin's grumbling and complaining, Drizzt noticed that Entreri didn't flinch at his friendly touch. Not at all. Minolin Fay gasped and put her hand to her mouth, thinking that such a sound probably wasn't a good idea with Ivanel posing naked, save a string of pearls belt with a tassel of gemstones cascading down over her right hip, that leg demurely crossed over her left. She wasn't gasping at Ivanel, who looked very beautiful and had been sitting like this for long stretches over the last several days. Well, in a sense she was. The reaction came from the image on the canvas in front of her, the portrait of Ivanel now being finished by Minolin Fay's mother, Matron Mother Burton Fay. Matron Mother Burton was a noted artist, her work always a pleasure to behold, and her best work manifested in portraits. But Ivanel had demanded no interpretation. She had explicitly instructed Matron Mother Burton to paint her exactly as she appeared. And Ivanel, this little tyrant who had sprung forth from Minolin Fay's loins, had gone further when explaining things to Minolin Fay. If Burton failed at this task, Ivanel meant to turn her into a drider. Looking at the painting now, undeniably beautiful, but surely quite different from the living Ivanel sitting on the divan in front of them, Minolin Fay believed her mother doomed. Matron Mother Burton nodded and stepped back, looked at Ivanel, then back at the painting, and she nodded again. "Grand!" Ivanel exclaimed, and she leaped up from her seat. "No!" Minolin Fay cried, drawing a surprised look from her mother and a knowing smile from Ivanel. "No," she said more calmly. "It must be presented formally, touched up to perfection and unveiled from beneath a proper cloth." Ivanel said nothing, just kept smiling. She didn't bother to collect the robes lying beside the divan, but patted on bare feet toward the canvas. Minolin Fay reflexively went for the canvas. "Do not touch that," Ivanel warned. She kept coming, and now her smile was dangerous indeed, one that chased Minolin Fay back from the canvas. The wife of Gromph, the mother of Ivanel, held her breath as Ivanel, naked as a baby but so deadly, came around the edge of the canvas. And there stood Matron Mother Beerton, smiling proudly, oblivious to the fate that was about to befall her. Minolin Fay closed her eyes. "Brilliant!" Ivanel shouted. And Minolin Fay jumped back and stared dumbfounded. The painting was beautiful, and yes, brilliant, but it hardly resembled the naked woman standing next to her.
"It feels as if I'm looking into a mirror," Ivanel went on. "Truly, your talent exceeds what my mother claimed."
"Your mother?" Matron Mother Beerton replied. "And which Beanri?"
"Your daughter," Ivanel said. "My mother. Minolin Fay Beanri."
Matron Mother Beerton stared at the woman curiously, and with a bit of ire, clearly. Though this was a Beanri daughter, and one who had paid Matron Mother Beerton well, she did not have leave to speak to a matron mother of a ruling house in such a manner. But Beerton's expression didn't hold when she turned to regard Minolin Fay, who nodded sheepishly.
"Ah, I see you have much to talk about, Mother," Ivanel said in a tease. "And grandmother."
She tapped the edge of the painting and walked away laughing. She didn't even pause to scoop up her discarded robes, just walked out naked into the hallway and closed the door behind her. Minolin Fay stared at the painting, well aware that Matron Mother Beerton's stern gaze was upon her. Perhaps she should have warned her mother. She just wasn't sure of her proper place around Ivanel.
Now she had to explain in any case, but even that urgency could not tear her eyes from the painting. She had seen Matron Mother Beerton's work many times in her life, and the discrepancy between the painting and the flesh of Evenel seemed so very odd to her, so very unusual. Even Evenel's hair was cut differently than the woman pictured, and her breasts were very different, not nearly as large as Beerton had painted. Manolan Fay ran her hands over her face and through her own white hair, unable to reconcile the scene in front of her, as she so often was where her unusual daughter was concerned.
"I was beginning to wonder if you would forget a courtesy visit and already be on your way," Catti Bree said, when Jarlaxle at last caught up to her in her tent beside the ruins of the host tower. There was no mistaking the edge in her voice, a purposeful reminder to Jarlaxle that she wasn't very happy with him pulling her husband back to the city of his birth.
"My associates are gathering supplies. It is a long journey, and not one where scavenging for food and water is advisable." He ended with a wink and a smile, but it was clearly lost on the woman. Jarlaxle merely shrugged then, and placed a stack of parchments and scroll tubes down on the table between him and Catti Bree. "Gromph has translated the Alusk references to the host tower, so that you might easily peruse them," he explained.
"How generous of him," the woman remarked sarcastically. "For alas, he would believe, wouldn't he, that such simple spells of translation are beyond me."
"I recognize and accept your anger," Jarlaxle told her, and he offered a gracious bow.
"You have no right to ask this of Drizzt."
Jarlaxle rocked back on his heels, which was not a typical response from the ever-wary mercenary. "Look around you," he replied. "Do you believe all of this happened by good fortune, or some spontaneous act of the gods? Those parchments on your table, do you understand the lengths I traveled to uncover them and decipher them?"
"I do understand. I have delivered Archmage Gromph to you," Jarlaxle interrupted.
"The Archmage of Menzo Baranzon, the most powerful drow wizard in Faerûn, and one who can destroy me utterly. You do not understand, good lady. Oh, certainly you comprehend the basic details of what I have done, but you do not begin to understand the risks I have placed upon myself, and upon my husband, yes, and upon you. Do you wish to secure Gontalgrim? If so, then this is how. It is not an easy task for any of us, and yes, I understand how the idea of Drizzt walking back into Menzo Baranzon terrifies you. But make no mistake here, Catti Bree, your own course is no less dangerous nor is mine. The victory we won to initially reclaim the Dwarven Halls might well prove the easiest one of all."
"What does Drizzt returning to Menzo Baranzon have to do with securing Gontalgrim?"
"Nothing," Jarlaxle answered, and he managed a smile. "And everything. This is not a journey to simply rescue his old companion. This is a quest to placate the Archmage and to give to him and to me and to all the other drow associates who now stand with your father a measure of hope and respect."
Catti Bree stared at him incredulously, and clearly she could not sort out those cryptic references. But Jarlaxle didn't back down under that scouring gaze. He stood resolute and even nodded to reaffirm his position.
"I must admit that it is an impressive assemblage you have gathered here," said Catti Bree. "Myself and Gromph and the Harples and 1,000 dwarves and Luskan helpers besides."
"We will rebuild this tower."
"Why?" Catti Bree asked. "Why is this so important to you?"
"Why is it so important to you?"
"King Brunner is my father and my friend," Jarlaxle said. But Catti Bree was shaking her head even as he answered. "Is it for your own power here in Luskan?" she asked. "Do you think the renewal of the host tower will strengthen your mercenary band? Or that it will perhaps offer more independence for you from the demanding and demeaning calls of the matron mothers of Menzo Baranzon?"
"It is all of that," Jarlaxle admitted.
"Archmage Gromph?" Yes, him too. I have many interests here, some my own, some for Bregentyirth, some for Luskin, some for Gromph. I do not deny any of that. But I also have interests here for King Brunner and for you, and of course for Drizzt, whom I have come to love as a brother.
Strong language.
I consider my every word carefully before I speak, Jarlaxle replied. Caddybree nodded, and Jarlaxle was glad that she would let it go at that. He wasn't really sure exactly what he was looking for beyond a few immediate gains. But there was something more, Jarlaxle knew in his heart, though he couldn't bring himself to admit it or express it. He went back to Gromph and to Matron Mother Xerath, the only Matron Mother who had ever, to his knowledge, truly appreciated the plight of Menzo Baranzon's male drow. Jarlaxle held no illusions that he could transform drow society, but he was determined to begin that shift at least, and in doing so, to bring himself a level of greater autonomy from the Matron Mothers of that city, particularly from his ridiculous sister, Matron Mother Quenthel.
It is an awesome force we have assembled here, Caddybree admitted, walking to the tent flap and looking out at the dwarves, who were already hard at work gathering together any surviving pieces of the shattered tower. Yet I fear our task will still be above us. I have looked at the parchments you earlier provided. She snorted and shook her head. I feel like a child trying to decipher the treatises of the great philosophers, or like a dim-witted goblin reading the spell book of Elminster. She turned back and offered a sheepish grin. But I am not alone, she said with a determined nod. We will get this done.
You are right to feel that way, Jarlaxle replied. We haven't gathered nearly enough of the information to accomplish the task before us. We have a chosen of Mialiki, a great accomplished drow mage, a cadre of lesser wizards, and an assemblage of the greatest dwarf masons and builders of this era. Also, and of no small importance, my associate communes with an illithid hive mind. But still there remain missing pieces. Caddybree studied him carefully.
But you know how to find those pieces,
she stated instead of asked. Jarlaxle laughed. All of the elder great races partook in the creation of the host tower of the Arcane, I believe, so yes, I have some ideas. Tazmakella and Ilnazara will arrive shortly.
The Dragon Sisters?
Dragon magic is among the most ancient, most powerful, and most lasting. Caddybree nodded her agreement. And we'll not stop there, Jarlaxle explained. And so I bid you to leave this place today. I have already spoken with Kipper Harple, and he has agreed to send you on your way. He smiled wider as he finished. I need an ambassador.
To where?
A place you know well, he replied, or knew well. With that, Jarlaxle tipped his hat. This is my last work here at this time, perhaps for many 10 days. My associates, your husband among them, await my return, and so I bid you farewell, Caddybree. He offered that typical disarming smile and started to turn, but Caddybree held him with her look. She bent down and picked up a bag that had been sitting at her feet, pulled it open, and produced a most remarkable black leather belt, set on one side with a brown cylindrical pouch and possessed of a striking mithril buckle, that Jarlaxle had seen before, shining silver and with the relief of a slightly recurving longbow on its face. That raised image had been cut out when Athrogate had taken the item from the Great Forge. "What is it?" he asked, taking it and studying the carving more closely. "It resembles the Heartseeker."
"A memento," Caddybree replied. "You will give it to Drizzt."
The mercenary nodded.
On your word.
Another nod and a reassuring smile. May Mialiki walk with you these difficult days and guide your steps toward what is best for you for your father and for you, she finished. Jarlaxle laughed, stepped forward, and kissed her on the cheek. Yes, he admitted. And is it not a wondrous thing that all of our interests are so perfectly aligned? We are, it would seem, of like heart. He tipped his hat again and strode out of the tent, making a straight line for the bridge to Close Guard Isle, which would bring him to another bridge to the mainland and the entryway to Illusk and the deeper Underdark, where Drizzt and Entreri waited. Soon after, Catti Bree stood in a familiar garden, sheltered by rocks from the great brown plain of Netheril. She lingered some time there, feeling the soft petals of the plants, rubbing her hand along the smooth back of the same young cypress tree that had given her the limb for the staff she now carried. She couldn't come to this place without being transported back in time, to her earliest days in this second life she now enjoyed. This was her secret garden, her secret refuge, the place where young Rukia had come to understand that Mialiki was with her still, and that the goddess would help her on her difficult journey. On a sudden impulse, Catti Bree took out the onyx figurine of Guinevere and called for the panther. She wanted Guinevere to see this place, to know this place. The gray mist became a black panther. Guinevere went off her guard almost immediately, and Catti Bree was glad. The gentleness of this garden refuge she had created could not be denied, not even by the blood that had been spilled there. The sense of peace permeated the air and filled her nostrils, and so filled Guinevere's too. "Let me tell you a story, Gwen," Catti Bree said, sitting down among the flowers, "of a little girl named Rukia, and the wonderful friends she once knew." Guinevere seemed to understand. Of course she did. And she settled in front of the woman, lying down and stretching, but never taking her large eyes or her attention from Catti Bree. Sometime later, Catti Bree moved out from the rocks and climbed atop a large one to afford herself a look over the land. Shade Enclave, the grand floating city she had once called home, was no more. Not up in the sky to the north, at least. Indeed, not up in the sky at all. The magic had been stolen by the advent of the Sundering, and the great city and the floating stone upon which it sat had fallen from the sky to crash upon the ground. Thousands had died in that cataclysm, so Kipper had told her, after Jarlaxle had explained it all to him, apparently. The carnage had been tremendous, both for those living in the floating city and those living on the ground in its shadow. But they had not all died. And so up there, amid the broken stones and fallen towers, an enclave of Netherese remained and thrived anew. "Lord Paris Ulfbinder," Catti Bree quietly muttered, and not for the first time as she strove to commit that name to memory, or to search her own memories to try to recall anything she might have learned of the great man in her days in Shade Enclave. He was alive, so Jarlaxle had relayed through Kipper, and it was up to Catti Bree to convince him to journey beside her back to Luskin. A strong wind blew down from the north, carrying stinging sand. Catti Bree pulled her black cloak tighter about her as a shield. Then she pulled it tighter still, so much so that its magic began to tingle all around her, as she and the cloak became as one. The woman turned crow, leaped off, and spread her wings, the strong winds lifting her higher and higher. She beat her wings and bucked the headwinds, making her way to what remained of Shade Enclave, and looking too for something else, for somewhere else, for a home more dear.